If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It may be that the deer who is deer is Anne Boleyn, or it may not be. He'll write himself and then deny it.
That was Susan Brigden, author of Thomas Wyatt, The Heart's Forest.
From the point of view of a democracy, it is crucially important that there is constant debate, constant engagement with not just contemporary issues, but with what's happened in the past.
And that was Christopher Duggan, author of Fascist Voices. These two historians have both just been awarded the prestigious Wolfson History Prize. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. See historyextra.com/subscribe-today for subscription deals. And we have digital editions available for the iPad, the Kindle, Google Play and Kindle Fire. For details of our digital formats, head to historyextra.com/digital. This week's podcast is a Wolfson History Prize special. First awarded in 1972, this accolade recognises the best accessible history works of the year and has gone on to become one of the most prestigious awards of its kind. Past winners include the likes of Anthony Beaver, Mary Beard and Ian Kershaw. On Tuesday, two new names were added to the roster, Christopher Duggan and Susan Brigden, who have scooped the latest awards for their books Fascist Voices and Thomas Wyatt, The Heart's Forest. Fascist Voices, by Professor Christopher Duggan of the University of Reading, tells the story of Mussolini's Italy through the voices of those who lived through the era. By analysing letters, diaries and police files, Duggan reveals a surprising level of enthusiasm for the fascist regime. In Thomas Wyatt, The Heart's Forest, Oxford historian Susan Brigden studies the life and work of the Tudor poet Thomas Wyatt, who was intimately involved with many of the key players of Henry VIII's reign. Famously, he was said to have been a lover of Anne Boleyn, and this is one of the mysteries of Wyatt's life that Brigden seeks to tackle in her biography. I met up with Christopher and Susan recently to discuss their respective works and to discover the secrets of writing award-winning popular history. Before we hear the conversations, here is a quick word from Paul Ramsbottom, Chief Executive of the Wolfson Foundation.
Well, the intention is that it will shine a light on two books that are exceptional works of history and that have a real resonance with a wider audience. So the intention from our perspective is really to highlight that type of work. So we hope that it comes as a real morale boost for the winners, as an encouragement to other people writing for a wider audience, albeit very much within a scholarly context. And I guess at a more parochial level, we hope clearly that it'll have an impact on the sales of the books, that it will encourage people to go and to read these wonderful winners. I'm always conscious that the timing comes out at the beginning of summer holiday period, and so I have these rather nice images of people heading off to beaches in the Mediterranean with a copy of each book under each arm.
That was Paul Ramsbottom. And now on to our panel discussion. I should mention that some of the topics we covered were suggested by Richard Evans, a member of the judging panel. You've both been awarded a prize for writing history that the general public can enjoy. What is it you think that makes a piece of history accessible?
Well, I think it's got to have people in it. It's got to have stories. And I guess there are certain subject areas that resonate with people. I mean, the Tudors obviously has huge popular appeal at the moment through novels, through films, and obviously through, you know, works like Susan's book on Thomas Wyatt. So I think you've got to try and choose a subject area. Mine was on Italian fascism, and whereas Italian fascism perhaps has not had, you know, a huge amount of popular coverage, obviously Nazism and fascism generally does. So I think it's a question of trying to find a general area that's going to resonate and then have an interesting angle on it, and one that normally has some kind of personal dimension, whether it's through biography or, in the case of my book, using diaries of ordinary people to engage the general reader as well as to shed light on a period.
Yes, and in Christopher's book, the voices, the fascist voices, are what lead you in. And I think as historians, we're trying to, you know, evoke the past and trying to imaginatively recreate the past and to take our readers into this world which is known or less known to them, and to introduce them to characters and to ask the question, were they like us? And sometimes the answer is yes, and sometimes really not.
Yeah, that's true. And I think you're inviting your reader to, in a sense, to put yourself in the shoes of your characters and say, as you rightly say, Susan, I mean, you know, would I have acted differently? What would I have done? How much is this a different world from the world that I experienced? How much is it similar? And very often it is, there are elements of similarity, but elements of difference. But I think it is, as Susan says, this transporting the reader to a different place, a different time, and to try and reconstruct, using one's imagination as well as one's sources, a different world, but a different world in which people can probably see themselves as well as see differences. I think that's important. And, you know, books that have, history books have quite a lot of success, can often be on quite, you know, remote countries or remote periods. There have been very successful books looking at, you know, China and the Far East in sort of earlier periods or whatever. So it's a question, I think, of trying to recreate as fully as possible the emotional, moral, intellectual texture of a period. And that can, and Brian, you've got people there, you can draw your reader in, I think, and hopefully get them emotionally engaged in the subject.
And I think we're trying to, there is such a thing as a historian's truth. We're really trying to discover what happened. And we're seeing history, I suppose, often sequentially. I mean, history is a story, and to present it thus is not to traduce the past, but to make it real. And to do that and to present a story, you've got to be writing in a way that one sentence follows from another and that you entice your reader to read on. I mean, the best historians have always tried to do that.
So do you feel successful popular history works more because of the way it's written than, say, the topic that's been chosen or perhaps the sources that have been used? Is it really the writing that really makes a work of history come alive?
Yes, I think so, because, I mean, you could write an article of rebarbative pedantry on the most interesting historical subject, the rise of Mussolini or the death of Anne Boleyn. But you could also write something fascinating about something that wasn't, you know, in itself appealing. I mean, you know, to tell the story of a Netsuke like Edmund de Waal does isn't an obvious ploy, but it's a story of extraordinary attraction.
And it's that different angle, as you said, the Hair of the Amber Eyes was just so unusual that you got in through the next week. And it opened up a whole world of, you know, late 19th century France and, you know, all the issues that came up with the Jewish question late 19th century and early 20th century as well. So it's having this sort of door interesting door that opens. And I mean, you asked if it's the writing. In a sense, you know, the prose has got to be as engaging and vivid as possible. But I think probably even more important is just having this rather different angle and being able to open up this extraordinary world. And sometimes just the range of sources can itself be intriguing. I mean, one thing that I was in awe of in Susan's book is just how in what detail you could reconstruct events in 1527 or whatever it is through traces. And that in itself was fascinating, just thinking that, my God, 500 years ago, we can reconstruct on a daily basis a horse rider going across through France to back to London. It's really quite exciting. So there's something about the sources themselves that can be quite intriguing, I think. And in the case of my book, I was using diaries, but also secret police reports and so on. I guess that must have a certain frisson for the reader as well, which can make it attractive.
But you also, I mean, there's the kind of history where you continue a debate within the academy. Mm. So you say, Duggan says, but I say, and then, and somebody else says. And that, in a way, is, I think that belongs to the historical journal, and that's for the world of the academy. For history to be accessible, I think you have to have two parallel stories in a way. There's the story above the line, which is, after all, what Gibbon did in The Decline and Fall of the text for his readers. And then below the line are the footnotes, and those are for the historians or the scholars who really want to follow the tracks and see the proofs. But if once you start introducing the sources very palpably into the text, or the names of your fellow scholars upon whom you rely tremendously, then you break the spell in a way, and you're no longer simply in the 16th century, you're in the 21st century. So that's why you choose, as you're writing something, you always find your own, your voice that tries to fit the story that you're telling. Gibbon describes the voice that he has to find to the historian of the Roman, of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, has to find. And all of us, not to compare ourselves to Gibbon, but we have to find a voice that suits the story we're telling, I suppose.
Do you two, when you're writing, do you have a picture of the reader in mind at all?
Yes, I mean, I do. I imagine my friends, or I imagine my undergraduates, or because after all, we're teachers before we're. I mean, that's how we spend most of our time.
Yes.
The writing is done in vacations or in time stolen from other things that we should be doing. I imagine the undergraduates, particularly ones who study particular courses with me.
Yes, I think you always have readers in mind, and sometimes a little bit schizophrenic, because you're aware of your academic colleagues hovering over your shoulder, and there, as Susan said, you make sure that your footnotes indicate that you do know your sources and you have read the latest articles or latest books on your subject. But then you've got the so-called general reader perhaps hovering over your shoulder, and then students. I mean, my last book, not the one on Fasci's Voices, but I was in slightly sort of caught between wanting to engage with general reader, somebody who might be going to Italy on holiday for a couple of weeks and wants to have a general history of Italy, but at the same time thinking of undergraduate students and what they might like from something with slightly more of a textbook feel. So in the case of that book, which I published 5-6 years ago, I sort of hovered between a sort of general narrative that might engage the general reader and something that might be of use to undergraduates as well. So yes, you're always aware of your audience, I think. Certainly with this book, Fascist Voices, I was conscious of addressing a major area of historical debate among professional historians, the degree to which there was consensus or support for the fascist regime in Italy, more broadly, support for fascism in Europe. Yet at the same time, wanting, partly because it's not, Italian fascism is not so well known as say Nazism, to try and draw in a bigger public and say, look, there's a lot that we can learn from Italy. You know, please read this book and, you know, start thinking about fascist Italy and don't just focus all the time on Nazi Germany. There's a lot to be learned from other countries as well.
Are there any potential pitfalls when writing this kind of popular history that is there a danger of sacrificing kind of the academic integrity or not really sort of dealing with the scholarship properly? Is it hard to balance the two sides to the work?
I think if you've got a publisher that lets you have as many footnotes as you like, then you can have two books, really. You can have your scholarly book below the line, and then you can have your book that isn't so rebarbative, I suppose, that people might want to read and find, the world that you're painting for them. But I suppose within the academy, people might despise you for writing in a more popular way. And, well, you know, that's their problem as far as I'm concerned, because I think historians have got a duty, really, to make important subjects known. I mean, I wouldn't make great claims for writing about Thomas Wyatt as containing, you know, huge truths for in modern politics, but to read Christopher Duggan's book and to think about the possibilities of, you know, the resurgence of right-wing groups within Europe, or to think about the silences there are in Italy about the past, is really to see that duty, I think.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Yeah, I think the issue of whether you feel compromised, I mean, it is a balancing act all the time. And I think But as Susan says, you can use things like the footnotes, or in my case, it's in the introduction. I try to address the issues which the book touched on in terms of academic debates, you know, the extent to which fascism was not a political religion or whatever. So you can make clear that you're conscious of these things. But I think as Susan says, I mean, the important thing in a way with so many topics is to try and generate debate. I mean, you know, as academic historians, we know there are no definitive answers. There are always debates, and the debates keep on and on. But the important thing is to keep those debates alive and to keep people questioning, thinking, challenging, and so on. I think one thing I wanted to do in my book is to say, well, this is what the evidence suggests. I can't tell you definitively the degree to which, you know, 40, 45 million Italians really bought into fascism or really supported Mussolini. There's no way you can come up objectively with an answer in that. Here's some evidence. Here are diaries, here are private letters, here are secret police reports, which indicate that a lot of people were emotionally really engaged with fascism, really engaged certainly with Mussolini. I can't tell you exactly what that says about levels of consent or support, but let's at least start thinking about it, discussing it, and get over silences, because one thing Susan said, there's so many areas of history, and this goes, I guess, for areas of British history, but certainly for large areas of European history of the 20th century, where there has been a lot of silence. I mean, I'm just finishing Paul Preston's great book on the Spanish Holocaust, and clearly there has been a huge amount of silence in Spain about exactly the level of brutality and killings in 1936 to 37 in Spain. I mean, Paul gives a figure of close on 200,000 people killed. But clearly the way he's writing this book is to say, well, look, we've got to confront this because it has not been confronted. And what we've got in Spain is a rather benign image of Franco, somebody who restored order, ultimately in the 1960s gave Spain the sort of foundations for its economic recovery, though it's a little bit more suspect now. But, there's been silence. And I think one of the things that Susan and I and other historians want to reach a broader public would like to do is just to open up areas that have not been fully discussed, fully thought about, and just get people talking. There are no final answers, but there is debate. And that's what we want to encourage.
Do you both feel that it's important that academic historians like yourself get involved in the popular history market and don't just leave it to the kind of these sort of amateur historians and historical novelists and people like that, that you have a voice? Because there is a lot of popular history being written by non-academics. Is it important to have people like you in the mix as well?
Well, I suppose the Tudor period is the one that is a period of great glamour and destiny, and lots of people want to write about it. And it has a historical novel of genius writing about it, which is Hilary Mantel. And I think that her powers of imagination and her sort of searing intelligence are just extraordinary. And I think actually that she wrote the best two pages that have been written or will be written about Thomas Wyatt. And I'm glad that I read Bring Up the Bodies after I'd finished my book. But it's still true that we, historians who are out there on the front line in the archives need to be writing our histories too. So partly, it gives them more material, but our truths are different from theirs in a way. I think that Hilary Mantel is looking for and finding historical truth, but in a different way than I am. I revere her. I don't revere people who are writing a kind of what I might call faction, which is halfway between true history and fiction, which is a kind of easy, facile enterprise, which is a kind of historical pap that doesn't have to do with truth or hard thinking.
I think that's absolutely true, and I agree with Susan on that. I think historical novels are one thing, and there's a kind of truth you can get from those, which is wonderful. I think there is a danger with historical books that claim to be serious history, but which are not written from a standpoint or with a rigour that professional historians would approve of. And I think they can be dangerous because the reader will pick those up at a bookshop, at airport, whatever it is. And, the blurb on the book will say, the truth about, Mussolini's execution exposed, whatever it is. They'll read it, say, my God, this is history. This is the truth. And yet, as historians, we're acutely aware that this is just often absolute nonsense. And certainly in the case of my subject on Italian fascism, or indeed Italian history, modern Italian history in general, I'm aware, particularly perhaps in Italy, there's a whole huge industry of writings by people who are not professional historians, but who write books which claim to be history, which have huge readership, and they really worry me. I just mentioned the execution of Mussolini. There are so many books backed up then by so-called documentaries on television in Italy, which claim that Mussolini was assassinating the orders of Winston Churchill or whatever it is, without any serious evidence for this. And those kind of works can do, I think, very serious damage. And I think we have a duty as historians to try and counter that by being absolutely clear about sources, showing people how you approach truth, in inverted commas. I mean, as far as one can establish truth, but by being as faithful as possible to the sources and with a degree of accessibility that allows you then, hopefully, to try and counter some of the more dangerous and corrosive material that is out there.
There are some historians, and I suppose people in many fields, who feel a little bit snobby about the idea of popular history. But do you think that what you're saying sort of shows the importance of academics engaging with popular history, because otherwise the public will be at the mercy of amateurs and charlatans, and so for academic historians to just be in their ivory tower could be quite dangerous to the public understanding overall?
Well, I think there is a place for really quite difficult history just written in a very bleak way, conducted in professional journals. And some historians are writing the sorts of history that fits best in that kind of medium. But for those of us who are, you know, writing about very exciting periods, it doesn't seem to me that there's any problem about writing for a general audience. I mean, historians, you know, words are our weapon in a way, and you know, if you can't write appealingly, then your sword is forever unsheathed, your argument is not properly made. History it's a very complicated matter often, but it needn't be explained in terms of obfuscation. You can write complex truths in a appealing way, I think.
I think it's very important. I think it's also something that British historiography has been very good at for many decades, indeed many centuries. And I think of the situation in Italy, which is obviously the country that I work on primarily. And in Italy, it is very, very rare indeed to find a professional historian who can engage or indeed wants to engage the general public. There is a very strong sense, I find, in Italy that if you are accessible, then somehow you're not a serious historian, which may be one reason why, and I'm very grateful for this, that British historians do get widely translated in Italy and can reach, you know, a relatively broad public. But I think it is you know, hugely important, and you know, that historians can reach broad publics. I mean, without want to sound sort of too sort of, you know, pompous on this, but you know, from the point of view of a democracy, it is crucially important that there is, you know, constant debate, constant engagement with not just contemporary issues, but with what's happened in the past, particularly with, you know, things like fascism. That you know, we are open, able to discuss these, whereas I see in Italy that you know, that the inability very often of historians to engage with a general public, a broader public, on serious issues like, you know, fascism, Mussolini, and so on, leaves, as I said earlier, the way open to pseudo-historians or to sensationalist or sensationalizing documentary makers to present a very distorted picture of the past, which can have very dangerous implications. So I think, you know, historians, we do have, I mean, duty sounds a little bit sort of over-serious, but I think, you know, there's a real role within democracies, part of the broader debate, to make sure that as, you know, wider public as possible is brought into discussions about the past as well as the present.
It's part of the wider debate about how history should be taught in schools, after all, and it's a matter of great controversy. And I think there are politicians and people who are in charge of education who really do recognise that without a knowledge of history, that you're forever a child, that you are condemned to repeat the errors of the past if you don't know the past. I think perhaps it does sound rather portentous, but I think that historians you know, have a humane influence, especially in a, you know, in a liberal democracy. I think in America too, there's a tradition of writing history in a popular way, which matters. And of course, the audience there is enormous.
Mm. Now, I realise you've both written on very sort of different subjects, clearly, but do you see any parallels between your two books?
Well, both engage with obviously real people and try to bring alive the world they lived in. I think one thing that you know, I found very striking about Susan's book was the sort of geographical breadth. And what I really enjoyed about, amongst many other things, is the way that, you know, the Reformation in England was brought into a European context, and the way that, you know, the court of Henry VIII and people like Wyatt were part of this broader European culture. And also European politics, the extent to which, you know, Henry VIII was desperately trying to lever himself into a position of influence in Europe generally, and ultimately, I suppose, rather failing, which I guess is, you know, a sign of things to come for the next four centuries or so, in terms of Britain's relations with Europe. And I think that European dimension to Susan's book, and the fact that my book is about Italy, does reflect, I think, a very, very important strand in British historiography, that there is, you know, such a strong tradition in this country of books being written about other countries. One just looks back through the list of you know, prize winners for the Wolfson Prize in the last 40 or so years. Huge number of these books have been about non-British subjects, you know, books that deal with, you know, America or aspects of European countries or the Far East or India, whatever it is. And I think that is something that is very, very significant about British historiography, something that may be a little bit under threat. I mean, a lot of debate about this the last sort of 10, 15, 20 years and about the problem of languages. But, you know, Susan had to look at archives in Spain and Italy, Germany. Without language skills, we're going to lose that ability. And the danger is might lose something that's very distinctive about British historiography.
And I suppose one of the things that links the books too is the sense of people, the voices of people who are making very hard moral choices in times of great uncertainty and danger, and, you know, looking for leadership or looking for you know, a sense of a politics to be trusted, and a sense of, you know, a nation whose path is you know, there are certain paths to be taken. Mm. So those things might link them as well.
Something that I was thinking in a very clearly quite a loose sense is you've got people trying to deal with quite a sort of difficult regime. You've got Henry VIII's obviously very hard to gauge how he's going to react to things, and also quite a dangerous man to cross. And similarly with Mussolini, if you fell on the wrong side of him, which was quite easy to do, you could come a cropper quite easily. So are there any parallels between the Tudor court and the fascist court, so to speak? Or is that stretching it too far?
Well, I think there probably are, in terms of, I mean, both are fairly sort of authoritarian regimes, and I think it's interesting to see how people respond emotionally, psychologically to these kind of regimes. And one thing that really struck me looking at the diaries of ordinary people in fascist Italy or their letters is the willingness to suspend critical judgment about the leader, and the desire to want to believe that the leader is somebody who is on your side, who's going to help you to be good, and so on. And the amount of emotional and psychological investment in that, and the way in which you put aside critical judgment. I was very struck with Susan's book when looking at Cromwell's fall in 1540, how, you know, it seems so brutally unjust, and yet Cromwell doesn't say to Henry, how how dare you do this? He says, I'm sorry, I betrayed you, or whatever. I mean, and, you know, I find in the case of Mussolini how extraordinary it is that even highly intelligent people who can see that the racial laws, the alliance with Germany and the entry into the war in 1940 is, you know, inhumane, unjust, wrong. Yet at the same time, they do not want to lose their faith in Mussolini. I mean, one, I'm very struck by an extraordinary diary of a very, very intelligent student, physics student from the University of Padova, who, you know, one moment can say, you know, why is Mussolini introducing the racial laws? They're iniquitous. Why are my professors from university being sacked just because they're Jews? The next minute she can record in her diary her sense of exhilaration at going to hear Mussolini give a speech and be proud of herself that she still has faith in the Duce. So it's something very, I think both books say something very curious about how people deal with power, particularly strong power, and what you do. We all imagine that faced with horrendous choices, like in the Third Reich or whatever, we'd all say, no, we wouldn't, you know, send the Jews to gas chambers. But you become aware that when you're faced with power, that you play very curious games emotionally, psychologically with yourself in order perhaps just to keep on living and to think that you're making the right choices.
And I suppose even at the court of a tyrant, you are still hoping that by your counsel you might try and speak truth to power. But of course that's much harder to do than to talk about. And I suppose my book is about people who are quite close to this, who are very close to this problem. They're making these moral choices. They're at court and trying to make sure that they come, you know, they come out as clean as they went in. But if that doesn't happen, that they're tainted. Everybody who lives, who countenances those regimes, is tainted by them.
And in both books, you have, well, particularly in yours, but I suppose also in yours, Christopher, you have a central character who is still quite an elusive character. Do you feel that you're able to get to the bottom of them finally after writing these books?
I think sometimes in my dark moments, I've thought that there's a sort of Wyatt-shaped hole in the middle of my book and that I could evoke the world around him. I could hold up his poetry as a kind of mirror of his times, but that he was evading me. They said at the time of Wyatt that he speaks fine words until he's more sure of you. And I think that sometimes I felt I was getting the fine words. This is a man who, in his letter to his son, a very revealing letter to his son at a time perhaps when he thought he might not see him again, talks to his son Thomas about gathering himself, to have a gathered self, to know himself. But with Thomas Wyatt the elder, I found so many selves. There was Wyatt the Christian stoic, and then Wyatt the murderer, and then Wyatt the sort of trolling Wyatt who'd write courtly verse, and Wyatt who was also the paraphrast of the seven penitential psalms, and he's a courtier who says that he's not going to flatter, and then we find him flattering. And so he's a figure of such complexity that he was always elusive. And I think if I left him still elusive, then I didn't too much traduce him. So I present these selves.
But that, I guess, is the reality of all human beings in the end. Again, not sound too pompous, yeah, but there are so many different layers. And I think, you know, one thing I found with researching Mussolini, but also I think looking at the responses of ordinary people to Mussolini, I mean, everyone is multi-layered. And you know, I said at one point, I think that I could well imagine somebody in Italy writing an effusive letter to Mussolini saying, Duce, I believe in you, you are my God on earth, I love you, etc., etc. And a few hours later in a bar over a drink with a colleague saying, oh, Mussolini's an idiot, isn't he, and so on and so forth. I mean, we all do that in various ways. We're rather sort of contradictory and complex. And certainly in the case of Mussolini, you know, he's somebody who, was playing so many different roles in the end, in a way that I don't think he could disengage the actor from the real self. He was somebody who, you know, saw himself always, whether in front of large crowds or in front of individuals, as playing roles. I mean, even with, I mean, we recently got access to the diaries of his most long-standing and famous or notorious mistress, Clarita Petacci, who record in huge details exactly what Mussolini said on a day-to-day basis to her. But you get this strong impression there that he is playing a part as much as any other time. He is, you know, first of all, he's sort of 25, 30 years older than her and playing the sort of, you know, the great man in front of her and boasting and showing off and so on and so forth. But that in the end is as much part of him, a real part of him, as any central inner truth, if you like. I mean, Mussolini, as I say, like so many people, is just playing lots and lots of different roles. And I think that's something that you know, works like Susan's or perhaps mine as well, brings out that in the end we are all very, very complex creatures and we play different roles and often contradict ourselves.
And there's, I think there's some interesting things in the sources that you both use. I mean, so in Christopher's case, you've got these letters and diaries that it's always hard to know how much these really represent someone's true feelings. And then with Thomas White, you've got all his poetry. But again, it's how much is that the real White and how much is that an image he wants to project of himself? Even when these things are written in private, it's still, is it possible to get a feeling of how accurate or how true these things really are? Or is it just an impossible quest?
It's very, very difficult. And one point I made about using diaries is, you know, why are people writing diaries? What kind of persona are they trying to project? Because, I mean, sometimes people, you know, will write a diary just to offload their feelings. In a way, that's the most sort of authentic and raw indication of what they're actually thinking or feeling. But very often people write diaries for other reasons. They may be thinking of posterity. They may be thinking of actually having it published. Lots of diaries I came across for soldiers in the Second World War or soldiers serving in Ethiopia in 35, 36. They were keeping them for their girlfriend or their wife back home to show what a good soldier or good fascist they'd been. So it's, you know, often a reason why they're writing it. And you've just simply got to think when you're reading a diary, you know, what is the motive for this diary? And therefore, what kind of image is the person trying to project of himself or herself? But in the end, if someone's trying to, and I found this when looking at diaries, for example, of school teachers. I was thinking, well, you know, these are, you know, so, you know, apparently such just, you know, statements about how what a wonderful teacher they are and how good they are as fascists. And maybe that they're sort of keeping these diaries, which might possibly be shown to a, you know, a head teacher or somebody to show how well they behave. But in a sense, that is as much part of their real person, the fact they want to project themselves as good fascists. So you can say, well, even if they didn't necessarily sign up 100% for the kind of things they're saying about Mussolini or fascism, the fact they want to project that to a superior or whatever it is says quite a lot about their commitment to the regime, even if it doesn't actually reflect necessarily their full inner feelings. So, but, you know, I think you've, you know, just got to be very critical of your sources. And I guess, Susan, the same with poetry. You've just got to sort of think, you know, why is someone writing to John Poyntz or not writing John Poyntz, whatever it is.
Yes. I mean, poets are alchemists. They can do anything. They range in the zodiac of their wit. That's what Philip Sidney says. But they, and a poet's truth is not the same as the truth for the rest of us. There are all sorts of constraints and inspirations for a poet that make the source quite different from anything else. As a poet like Wyatt is constrained by his own nature, he's constrained by his times. He's writing at a time when, under the Treason Act, words are now treason. So his life nearly ends on the difference, on a distinction between syllables. And he says that the distinction between a difference of syllables maketh a great difference. But he's also thinking of form, and it's form that's his inspiration. And he's imitating great poets, especially Petrarch. So he must write with the compression to follow the form of the sonnet. So, and he's trying to imitate, he's imitating Horace, or he's imitating Alemanni, who's imitating Ariosto, imitating Horace. You've got something, the poem is a palimpsest, and what you can never do is to try and ransack it for a certain time, a certain place, a certain person. That really is to traduce the poet. So it may be that the hind that he describes in Whoso List to Hunt, it may be that the deer who is deer is Anne Boleyn, or it may not be. He'll write himself and then deny it. So, and he'll speak and keep silent, and you have to follow him through all those silences until you find a voice, or you find a moment where you can be more certain of him, I suppose. But you've got to track him and be cautious and stealthy.
And how far did you feel you had to be true to the original sources? Because something that Richard actually wanted to ask you, Susan, was about maintaining the original spellings of Thomas White, because he wondered whether, about the choice you made between whether to make it, I suppose, a bit easier for a modern reader, but then also want to keep to the original. Why did you decide to stick with the original spellings in the end?
Well, that was really difficult, because I knew that if I didn't put Wyatt in his original spelling, he sounds different if you put him in English, in our modern English. You don't get quite the plays on words. If you put punctuation in, you don't find the truth sort of hovering between the lines. That was one of the hardest decisions. But this is a man who is going to go to the block on the difference between whether he said the king is left out of the cart's arse or cast out of the cast arse. So when he says that it maketh a difference to the truth, a syllable, he really knows and he means it. And so I didn't think that I could be one of those editors who'd edited Wyatt and put in a syllable here to make the rhyme smoother or to put him into modern English. I think once you get the hang of it, once you start reading him aloud as he would have been, then it becomes much easier. And I made all sorts of rather compromised decisions, I suppose. So because Wyatt's friends are not in their original orthography, and Wyatt's diplomatic letters are not in his writing and his spelling, but the poetry, I had to stay firm, I think. But it was difficult.
But it worked. I think it worked very, very well. I thought it was an excellent choice to make, because, you know, again, it's getting at this point about taking your reader back to an earlier period which is different and yet which has close resemblances in many, many ways. And I think, you know, the archaic English rather does that. You get you think, well, this is England. It is my country, or whatever it is, but it is slightly different. And also there's just this sort of, I find it sort of fascinating to try and sort of, you know, to have to read and reread the poems to actually get used to it. So it came like a sort of, not quite a crossword puzzle, but something, but intriguing, and part of the excitement of the book, getting back into the world of the 16th century, to have to slightly, you know, wrestle, to begin with at least, with this rather unfamiliar English. So I think it worked very well. And it would have been alienating, I think, to have translated the 16th century English into modern English, because then you've had the modern voice intruding into the recreation, which is, you know, what the book is trying to do, recreation of that world of the 16th century. You know, in my case, I had no choice but to translate, but to translate, you know, the aim for me was to translate in a way that reflected the tone of the Italian as much as possible.
But some of your diaries were almost impossible to penetrate, weren't they? I can't remember the name of the man who wrote
on his Olivetti.
Oh, yes.
Word by word, separating every word with a semicolon.
Yes, yes.
And he was only marginally literate, really, but he wanted his story to be told. I mean, that was very... And, you know, night after night, he was writing his account, that the truth be told.
That is difficult when you've got someone who's writing, in the case of Vincenzo Rabito, you mentioned, he's writing in a very curious town in basically Sicilian dialect, and it was going to be almost impossible in English to bring across that sort of distance from modern Italian. But yeah, I mean, in the case of diaries of children or whatever, you try a little bit to replicate the sort of childish feel of the writing, but the challenging was very different from one that Susan faced. I think, I mean, no choice but I think to translate.
But I think, in a way, you were making it easier for us than and doing us a tremendous favour. But I mean, even now, if you go to Naples, the language of the streets is not something that the rest, you know, even those who can speak a bit of Italian can understand. And so each of those voices that you were presenting for us was speaking a language that would be hardly recognised as standard Italian, because standard Italian is the creation of the television, I suppose, isn't it, in part?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it's only in the 1970s the majority of the Italian population spoke Italian as their first language, as opposed to dialect. So, yes, a lot of these people who were writing diaries or letters were struggling with Italian. So, yes, I mean, it's important to sort of be able to bring out their voices, and often these are voices which in Italy as well are not easy to be heard, precisely because, as you suggest, the language is not always one that modern Italians would be very familiar with.
And something else that I suppose applies to both your books is they both take on some quite big questions of their period. I suppose you've got the whole question of Anne Boleyn and Thomas Wyatt, whether or not they were a couple, and then, I know this is quite different, but in your book, Christopher, you've got, did the Italian people really support Mussolini? These are two quite big topics that a lot of other people have addressed. Do you feel that your books have settled these matters now, or is it still up for debate?
Well, I think I haven't settled really the matter of Anne Boleyn and Thomas Wyatt. I think that there's a will among anybody who sees their fascination now, and anybody then who saw their fascination, they left other people behind at that court. Although people saw their difference, there was a sort of inevitability that these people of a kind of, you know, glamour and destiny would get together, and there, you know, we can imagine them romping in the Kent countryside in their childhood. I think it wasn't like that. There was so much to prevent them actually having, you know, a romance that was consummated. Wyatt's marriage, you know, the court constantly on the watch for this kind of thing. That it's hard to tell. It seems slightly prurient to tell. Of course, it does matter, because Wyatt is a great poet, because Anne Boleyn is a queen, and she's the mother of a greater queen, and so these are not matters without moment. But I think after 500 years, there are things that you can't tell. It'd be wiser not to speculate.
In the case of fascism, the debates will go on and on about this, and we've seen the case of the Third Reich, Nazi Germany, how sort of pendulum swings backwards and forwards between people saying that there was a huge level of, you know, of support, you know, Hitler's willing executioners and so on. Then the pendulum swings back again towards saying that, well, there was a huge amount of coercion. We must emphasize the coercion and the extent to which people were forced to conform and to obey. And then more recently, I think the pendulum swinging back again in the case of Germany to saying, well, actually, the distinction between, you know, good Germans, bad Nazis is not one that we can make. And in fact, you know, many more people than we perhaps imagined, really bought into the broader agenda of Nazism, even if they didn't actually support the Nazi Party. In the case of Italy, as I say, I don't think there's, again, to be a definitive answer on this one, but I think what I hope I've opened up is some new avenues for thinking about fascism. The relationship with the Catholic Church, I think, is one that has not been faced up to, for various, perhaps understandable reasons, as squarely as it should have been. But I'm very conscious of the extent to which, right from the start, that fascism's authority in Italy owed a huge amount to the really quite strong support, almost from the very beginning, of senior clergy in Italy. Not just in 1929, when the conciliation took place between the fascist state and the Vatican, but long before that. And, you know, if you think that for the Catholic Church, liberalism, almost as much as socialism, was an enemy to be fought, you begin to understand, you know, the extent to which fascism, for all its faults as far as the Catholic Church concerned, with its paganism and violence, could nevertheless seem a much better bet, both than socialism and also liberalism. And that gave fascism a huge, huge advantage. And of course, the liberal state had never had the formal backing of the Catholic Church. So that's something to be really emphasized. And I think, again, you know, thinking of Paul Preston's book on Spain, but also thinking about fascism in South America, it's something I think we need to think about rather more than we have done. And, you know, the importance of the relationship between fascism and backing of the Catholic Church. And the other thing I think I want to try and do in the book was to place the period 1922 to 45 in a broader context, because it's very easy just to sort of isolate the period and say it was all about, you know, class or whatever it is. But if you think that most of the people who you know, alive in 1922 would have their memories shaped by the, you know, 30, 40, 50 years that gone before, then you can only understand fascism in the context of all the disappointments, the frustrations, the you know, the anxieties that have gone before, disappointments about the First World War, the dislike of liberalism, the corruption of parliament, the fragmentation in parliament. All these things helped then shape how people approach fascism. And even if they didn't like aspects of Mussolini or the fascist party, nevertheless, they could really embrace the kind of hopes, the aspirations that fascism seemed to be engendering in terms of national regeneration, respect finally in Europe, having a united nation, the sense, you know, the past being fragmented, now we're one people with a common destiny. All these things, I think, helped to give people a sense that they could support fascism, even if they didn't like aspects, the corruption of the party, aspects of Mussolini. So it's, I think what I hope to do is to try and open the debate out and suggest more broadly why these regimes, fascism in Italy or perhaps, you know, Nazism in Germany or Franco in Spain, might be attractive. But, you know, you can't settle the debate. All you can do is, say, raise questions.
The most chilling part of the book, though, of your book, is the epilogue, I think, mm-hmm. where the entries that are made, where is it?
Pradappio, where Mussolini is buried, yes.
Mussolini's mausoleum, where people are still, you know, writing in 2010 to the Duce and thinking of the great man, and they don't exactly mention the Third Rome now, but they pine for him.
Hmm. There's a lot of nostalgia, I think. I mean, again, you can't quantify this, but it's true that you're getting dozens, sometimes hundreds, and occasionally on the big anniversaries, 1,000+ people writing, signing the commemoration book in front of Mussolini's tomb, and writing quite often lengthy inscriptions of praise to him. Yes, it says something about the way in which, if the past is not confronted squarely, how it is very easy for myths to remain powerful. In the case of you know, Italy today, I mean, we're just seeing at the moment the utter mess that's been, you know, taken place in Italy since the elections in February, inability to form a government, recently the failure to even elect a new president. They've had to go back to poor old Giorgio Napolitano, who the last thing he wanted, aged 86 and 87, or 87 and 88. Whatever. He's become president yet again, but he's had to. And, you know, there's this widespread feeling in Italy that And it is reminiscent of what was happening back in, you know, nearly 100 years ago, that this is a system that's not working. It's parties that are self-serving. It's fragmented and so on and so forth. And, you know, it's very easy in those circumstances for people to think, oh, well, things were better when we had, you know, one strong man who had a, you know, was able to unite us as a nation and so on and so forth. And so, you know, how easy it is for myths to be resurrected. And in that context, how easy it is for people to bat away any criticism and to say that the people who have criticized Mussolini, what's happened quite a lot in Italy the last 20 years, is to argue that anti-fascism and the criticisms of fascism Mussolini have been inspired by the communists. But you can then say, well, the communists discredited, therefore anti-fascism discredited. And so in a way you can sort of bat away any criticisms in order to protect what you want, i.e. a sort of, you know, mythical image of a great man who might offer hope.
And I suppose there also is, with the Tudor period, quite strong myths developed, don't they, in sort of the popular imagination about them. I mean, I guess they might not be as dangerous as they are with the fascist period, but it still is an issue for historians that they do need to confront some of these myths.
Yes, I think that the hold of the Tudor monarchs, especially Henry VIII and Elizabeth, on the popular imagination is extraordinary, and a kind of mythic quality surrounding them. Fortunately, Henry now is seen more as a monster than as a sort of founding father. But here is a man who destroyed so much. And there are those who really, it's hard to think of the Reformation, I think, as other than a tragedy in some ways. For those who lived through it, there are gains and losses, I suppose, but in the way that it was done, the pain remains. Elizabeth, who was quite controversial at her in her time, I suppose, remains it would be hard to gainsay this, the real achievement of her reign.
That was Christopher Duggan and Susan Brigden in conversation. I'd like to thank Paul Ramsbottom and the Wolfson Foundation for lending us their premises to record the interviews. And if you'd like to know more about the Wolfson History Prize, please visit wolfson.org.uk/history-prize. Both Christopher and Susan's books are, of course, on sale now. Fascist Voices, An Intimate History of Mussolini's Italy, is published by Bodley Head, while Thomas Wyatt, The Heart's Forest, is published by Faber. We'll be reporting on the Wolfson History Prize in our June issue, which goes on sale in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, you can still get hold of our May edition, where we have articles on Second World War misconceptions, the Dambusters raid, Roman gladiators, royal clothing, King John, and the legacy of Margaret Thatcher. Our May issue is available in all good newsagents and digitally. And as I mentioned earlier, you can find more information on our digital editions at historyextra.com/digital. Well, that's almost all for this week. Do get in touch with your views on podcast@historyextra.com, and we may well read out some of your messages in future episodes. You can also contact us on Twitter, we're @HistoryExtra, and on facebook.com/HistoryExtra. Next time, we'll be back in Bristol discussing King John's battles with the barons and speaking to a survivor of the Holocaust. It's an episode that you won't want to miss. The History Extra podcast is produced in Bristol by Jack Fletcher.